Welcome to Dialogue. I'm George Liston C.A. Like a lion in winter, the force of nature that was Theodore Roosevelt could not be constrained. The passionate energy that had driven his presidency consumed his persona in his post-White House years. His last decade of life embodied causes, fights, and themes that would have exhausted a dozen lesser beings. But for all of his intellectual and physical vigor, he may never have understood the degree to which power itself ranked among his grandest ambitions and greatest needs. My guest is Patricia O'Toole, author of When Trumpets Call, Theodore Roosevelt After the White House. Patty O'Toole, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks, George. Great to be here.
Perhaps, Patty, we might do well at the outset of our conversation for you to remind our modern audience of the vast appeal this president had for the American public. I think at one point in the book you referred to him as an artist in power, and that artistry seemed to have a great resonance, at least at the outset, with the American people. And I guess one way to think about this or phrase the question is, can we think of him as sort of America's first celebrity president?
He was America's first celebrity president and really one of America's first celebrities. Mm-hmm. This is an age before the celebrity and the brand name, and he was both those things. He moved into the White House. He's the youngest president. JFK was the youngest elected president, but Roosevelt became president when McKinley was assassinated, and he was 42 when that happened. And so you get this very young, energetic, appealing man moving into the White House, and he's got six children, all of whom are rambunctious and playful and outgoing. And so it's and they made themselves more accessible than previous families in the White House had. Certainly the Lincoln children were somewhat well-known, but it's hard to think of any others in between. So they became kind of the nation's first family in a way.
Right. After Teddy Roosevelt leaves the White House, Patty, it seems to me that, and I think this might be at least one of the cruxes, if you will, of the story, he seems to face a double need. One is the need for income. Another great crux of this book, if you will, and one of its most dramatic underthemes is his disenchantment, his growing disenchantment with William Howard Taft as kind of the custodian of his legacy. Seems to me that gets detonated early in his post-presidency and sets off so much that follows.
Yes, it's absolutely key to what follows. Mm-hmm. He hand chose William Howard Taft to succeed him. Taft had served in his cabinet as Secretary of War and had been a very able lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And Roosevelt had been very impressed by him. He was also earlier on, he was Governor General of the Philippines, and that was a difficult assignment that he'd handled very well, and he did a little diplomatic troubleshooting also. Again, acquitted himself very well. Before he went to Washington, he'd been a judge and had done very well at that. So Roosevelt really had every reason to think that he would succeed as president.
Right. And with Roosevelt's passion, when he decided he had essentially been, I don't know if betrayed is too strong a word, but when it enters his mind that Taft is not who he thinks he should be, that Rooseveltian passion and energy really began to turn toward what Roosevelt's going to do about it. This is going to be an activist response, if you will.
Yes. He was always in there giving his all, and he thought everyone should do that all the time, and he was very impatient with people who didn't. And, you know, most people aren't like that. Most people get tired and or they can fight one fight, but they can't fight 10 fights. They just don't have the energy. And he really did, when he was in, after he finished his safari, which was in the spring of 1910, he made this trip through Europe.
Right.
He had invitations to do various things, and then more invitations came. And he had an invitation to speak at the Sorbonne in Paris, and he gave this speech on the duties of a citizen in a republic or some title, sober title like that. Mm-hmm. And in it, there is this paragraph about how it's not the critic who counts. It's the man in the arena, the man who's actually in there covered with sweat and dust and blood and striving to do the deed, and he may fail. Great effort does not always bring great triumph, but in the end, he will never know the sort of cold fate of those timid souls who never know victory or defeat.
That is, and it's a beautiful passage. You have it quoted in the book. It's gorgeous reading. I wonder, as we sit here, Patty, is that a moment? I don't know if there's any one specific moment, but does his decision to, in a sense, challenge Taft coalesce with those words, so that he's still the man in the arena. He's still going to, you know, he's going to do something about the fact that his successor is not up to standard.
I think he tried very hard not to. His Republican friends were telling him, you know, just stand by. We're going to lose in 1912, but you shouldn't get mixed up in this, and then the field will be clear for you to run in 1916. And Roosevelt persuaded himself that the country couldn't wait, that this was the greatest crisis since the Civil War. And I don't think it was. I don't think there's any way you can analyze it so it comes out that way. But he was, and this is all out of his anger and disenchantment with Taft.
And this is right at the point where I want us to talk about that 1912 election, because this is pivotal. And I think a phrase you use here is a moment of transfiguration in American politics. But even before that, Patty, let me get you to comment on this. The reasons, I mean, I'm fascinated by the reasons that his ire would you know, lead him in the direction it did. And here, a thought that occurred to me as I read from beginning to end was that he was a man who seemed to be really inspired by his own imagination. I mean, I think he really imagined himself, saw himself as a hero. The heroic mode, the fact that you had to not just say something, but actually, you know, pull out your sword and run up the hill about it.
Oh, he grew up on that literature of knights and Vikings, and he loved all that heroic literature and really did see himself in those terms and strive to be a hero. His big hero in his life was his father, and his father died when T.R. was 19. So to me, that's very telling about him, because what it meant, I think, is he never got to, in real life, have the praise from his father that he was doing the right thing. And that's the one thing that he really wanted. So he was always striving to be a hero to the people he loved and the people who loved him. And that's absolutely key to understanding him. It's not an abstraction to him at all. It's very much a way of life. He was, when he was going off on the campaign of 1912, Mrs. Roosevelt was trying to line up some books for him to read, and she was asking somebody to buy some, and she said, "He likes trash," by which she meant like detective stories, and anything in which he can see himself as the hero.
And all of those feelings and all of that passion and all of that belief lead him into the election of 1912, which you called transfiguring. Why that verdict, Patty, and briefly, what did he do?
He had almost two full terms as president. McKinley was assassinated about 6 months into his second term, so T.R. served 3.5 years. Then he ran on his own steam in 1904 and was elected. So right after he was elected in 1904, on election night, as soon as he was sure that he had won, he made an announcement that flabbergasted everyone. He hadn't told anyone he was going to do this, that he wouldn't run again in 1908 because he was going to, you know, stick to the basic two-term tradition that
had been in place. Which was not a matter of law in those days.
Not a matter of law until after World War II. But he wanted, and he's always very much concerned with his standing in history, and I think that's what this was about, that he didn't want to seem too greedy. He wanted to, you know, make the best of the time that he was given but not overplay it. And then when he decided to run in 1912, he'd been out of office for a term, and people said, well, what about that? What about this two-term tradition? And he said, well, that only applies to incumbents, because when you're out of office, you don't have all the power of the incumbency. And so it's not like you're, you know, trying to install yourself as emperor and just stay there forever. So he felt he was perfectly entitled mm-hmm. to do this. And the literature on the subject bears him out, actually, mm-hmm. When you go back and look at the history of people making these decisions in the past and right. legal scholars thinking about it. And so he decides, first of all, that he's going to try to get the Republican nomination away from William Howard Taft, mm-hmm. who is going to run again. And that would be as if, say, in 2004, John McCain had, or some previous Republican president, Gerald Ford, if he were younger, had come back mm-hmm. and said he wanted to get the nomination away from George Bush. Mm-hmm. So he tries to do that. And by the time he goes to the Republican convention in Chicago, it's clear that he's not going to have the votes in the mm-hmm. convention to do it. So he spends his time at the Chicago discrediting the convention, saying it's a totally corrupt convention, which, in my view, allowed him then to bolt the party mm-hmm. In a sort of honorable-looking way and form a new party, because that was the only way to continue his run for the president. And then
the Progressive Party.
The Progressive Party, mm-hmm. familiarly known as the Bull Moose Party. And then they're up against Woodrow Wilson, this ingenue, political ingenue, governor of New Jersey for only 2 years. That was the full extent mm-hmm. of his political career. So Wilson had the advantage of not having any political
challenge.
Baggage.
Mm-hmm.
He was completely clean. He'd been a progressive governor of New Jersey. And this election is really all about defining a more progressive agenda for American politics. So you get the Democrats being progressive for, really creating modern mm-hmm. liberalism is what the beginning of Woodrow Wilson's administration and his domestic policies were all about. And Roosevelt with his own idea of a progressive agenda, which was much more – it was more friendly to business than mm-hmm. – Wilson's in many ways, although Wilson thought of a way to deal with certain economic right. issues that was, in the end, more pleasing to the business community. And then Taft representing the conservative side mm-hmm. of things. And in the end, 77% of the American electorate decided that it didn't want William Howard Taft in the White House mm-hmm, anymore. Mm-hmm. Wilson did not get a majority of the votes. He got 42%, I think, and Roosevelt got 27 or 28, and Eugene Debs got 6%. That was mm-hmm, the largest mm-hmm. he ever pulled, almost a million votes. So you had this great, it was probably the most leftish kind of election
right.
up to that point in American history.
And, of course, the winner is Woodrow Wilson. And it was interesting to me as I read all that. I said, you know, here you have a sitting president, and he's almost an afterthought in this, or almost certainly an also-ran when things play out. And it's interesting also, Patty, that with Taft's departure from the presidency and Wilson's assumption of the office, we're soon to see real animosity from Teddy Roosevelt directed toward Woodrow Wilson. I mean, this becomes another theme of the book, don't you? I mean, at some point, he really it's personal as well as political,
yes,
it seems.
Yes,
almost.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. that, to me, was very telling. If you wanted to buy his arguments on their face about, well, William Howard Taft had just been a bad steward of Roosevelt's progressive legacy, and that's why Roosevelt had to do this, then what about what happens when Wilson becomes president, when Roosevelt very swiftly transferred all the animosity that he had directed toward Taft.
Yeah.
Wilson had hardly had a chance to do anything
yeah.
before Roosevelt couldn't stand him. And that, to me, just said volumes about how Roosevelt thought nobody could be president as satisfactorily as he could be.
He criticizes Wilson, I think, correctly for an unpreparedness and the sense of America's military not being up to speed. You know, so he's pressing it on the one hand, he's excessively romantic on the other, but it seems to me his bitterness grows as he's kept out of the war.
Yes, Wilson didn't want to give him any role in the war. And I was talking about this with Tom Daschle, and he was commenting on that. And I said, well, if you were President Wilson, would you have given Theodore Roosevelt a role in the war? And he said, no, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. And obviously, everything one could know about Theodore Roosevelt, how he enlarged any position that he had. If you gave him a small role, he would turn it into a big role. Mm-hmm. And what he really wanted was to run again for president in 1920.
That's right. Because almost Shakespearean, because, you know, his lifespan is such that 20 is very feasible for him to think of himself as a presidential candidate. But it's going to be, he's going to be dead.
Yeah.
By that. And, of course, he doesn't know that.
Yeah. No, he doesn't know that.
With all this going on, let me raise a few things he didn't do. Starting with the World War One period, because his journalism is very active all the time, and he's gotten some very great outlets for his columns, and he's obviously the premier public figure. But I must confess, Patty, I found some of his expressions or attitudes about things like press freedom and censorship and so forth in that period a little troubling, what he was willing to accept, at least in terms of other people's writings, being... That's right.
He very much had a double standard about that. The press was quite clamped down on during World War One, and newspapers more or less had to go along with this or be put out of business, small newspapers in particular. And a lot of small publications were put out of, who stood their ground on issues, were put out of business. Something like 1,500 people went to jail for dissenting from the war. Various professors were fired, even at, we now think of Columbia University as a bastion of liberalism, but three, I think, Columbia professors were fired for their opinions on the war. There was a point when Roosevelt was very critical. He was at many points very critical of Wilson's management of the war. And one of his columns in particular, I've forgotten which one, led somebody in the government to accuse this newspaper of being in violation of the sedition laws. Mm-hmm. And there was some thought that they might have to give up his column or, pay some big fine or somebody would have to go to jail. And Roosevelt was furious about this. He thought that everybody should be able to criticize the president, praise the president when the president's doing the right thing, and criticize him when you thought he wasn't. But when certain other people did this from certain different perspectives, socialists, for example, or people who didn't think that Germany was as horrible as the reigning American opinion thought it was, he had no patience for that at all in one of them. So he fought for freedom of expression, but on a very narrow front.
Selective kind of basis. Two additional things, Patty, and this in the context of his genuinely progressive politics and interest in them. But I'd have to say that one could argue that he came very tardily to the notion of women's rights and seems to me embraced it with growing enthusiasm as women got closer to the vote. I mean, it didn't seem to me that he was really out there championing the issue. And that was tardy, and one could argue he was absent insofar as what was called the Negro question in its day. That would be the arcane phrasing of civil rights issues. And the best I could think was that one might say he equivocated on it. I don't know what you would say about it.
Yeah, he did with to take the women matter first. It's interesting because a lot of his social progressivism was informed by women reformers whom he befriended.
Jane Addams
and Lillian Wald of the Henry Street Settlement House in New York and various people who worked on pure milk laws and education and shortening working hours for women and children, all those sorts of things he cared instinctively about. And it was women who were dealing with those issues. And it just, as he said later, it just never occurred to them that having the vote would do them any good. Hmm. He sort of thought that husbands would do the right thing, you know, if right-thinking men like him managed to persuade other men to do the right thing, then what did women need the vote for? But they finally persuaded him that if they could vote, you know, their votes would outweigh
Patty, before you even discuss the, quote, Rooseveltian attitude on the Negro question, this thought just occurred to me as you spoke, that he was really, to give him his due on this, he was kind of at the cusp of the cutting edge between the Victorian age and the modern age, wasn't he? I mean, a man who could think that women, the men could be the stewards of their wives in a sense, was relating to a very kind of ancient thing.
Right. He did not have a modern view of this at all. And he definitely thought in the most old-fashioned ways about the role of a father and a husband and the mm-hmm. role of a wife and a mother. And it was the role of the father. I mean, it was a very patriarchal view mm-hmm. of the world in the most benign sense of that word. That's the father's role to take care. So mm-hmm. the father discovers an injustice, whether it's to women, to Negroes, to labor, then the father must deal with this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that would translate also into African-American issues.
I think so. With that, it's a much murkier kind of thing. And he, what he did in 1912, and there he is founding this new party. And in those days, there weren't that many blacks in the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. And in the South they weren't wanted. You know, that was a mm-hmm. it was a white man's mm-hmm. party, the Democratic Party, and so he's founding this new party, and everybody in the North is fine with this. There were quite a number, I guess, of black delegates to the Progressive Party convention from northern states. But in the South, the white men who were setting up the state party organizations mm-hmm. ran into a lot of resistance. And some of them just didn't even want black members of the party. Mm-hmm. And the reason that the way Roosevelt tried to make this palatable to more forward-thinking people was, well, we can't change the South overnight, so we're going to gather together the best white men in the South to work on this, and we have to take their point of view about it, and they're the ones who will bring other people mm-hmm. along. That's why you eventually have Martin Luther King writing in his letter from the Birmingham jail, "We just can't wait anymore,"
right,
But that was the line of argument. So he had a kind of two-pronged mm-hmm. strategy. We're open to blacks in the North, but we're not in the South, or we're letting it sort of be a local option in mm-hmm. the South. Mm-hmm. And he made a campaign speech in Atlanta, and the Atlanta Constitution really bawled him out about this. They just labeled it as complete, and these are, white Southerners labeling it as complete hypocrisy. They said, "Go home. We don't want you here." You're talking one way in the North, another way in the South. It's completely transparent.
Mm. Last years of his life are the years, obviously, of World War I. He's failed in his attempt to lead his volunteer regiment or division, but his four sons are caught up in it, and one of them, Quentin, dies as an airman. The others are wounded. What's this period like for him? I mean, it seems to have a cast of melancholy. I don't know if that is a reading of how he thought about it, though.
He thought that the war was a just war. Mm-hmm. He thought that it was that the Germans and their militarism had to be stopped. Mm-hmm. That the Germans had started this war. They'd invaded Belgium and France, and therefore the moral response is to push them back, to defeat them. Mm-hmm. And he believed that wholeheartedly. And so he was heartbroken that he couldn't go to France and run the same risks that his sons had run. No one wanted him. He thought that Wilson had done him in, but actually the British didn't want him to go. And
the French didn't want him to go.
Mm-hmm. So he's very frustrated. Then add to this the fact that the war effort was a total disaster. No mobilization on this scale had ever happened before. And mm-hmm. just trying to think about doing such a thing without computers. I mean, there were one of the big disasters was
the planes were never built.
Mm-hmm. $1 billion, hugest appropriation ever, and the mm-hmm. planes never got built. And the word went out very early on that boxcars all over the country should be loaded with everything, and all that should be shipped to the eastern port so that it could be transported to Europe. So all the railroad cars ended up, there was this terrible traffic jam at the eastern ports. There were no railroad cars anywhere else. And just one thing after another, after another, after another. So he was quite critical of that in his newspaper columns.
Which brings us to the conclusion of our conversation, Patty, in this last question. We now have, thanks to you, this admirable depiction of the last decade of his life. And I guess it's a direct, simple question. What does this give us? How does this frame the picture? What do we now understand through this? I'm sure there are many things, but what in particular would you say?
About Theodore Roosevelt?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think we understand how something huge has been lost with the concept of hero being old-fashioned now. I can't think of anyone on the scene in any field who would really qualify as a hero in the mold that he aspired to be a hero. I think this period in his life shows a lot of things about the rest of his life that if he hadn't had this experience, if he hadn't been so concerned with power, it wouldn't be possible to see the ways in which power shaped the other periods in his life. His progressive legacy, the thing that he started with the square deal when he was president and that got derailed by Taft, got reignited again in 1912 and derailed again by World War I. But it never really went away. A lot of the things that are in the progressive platform of 1912 were ideas that were put into practice with the New Deal. The whole idea of old age insurance, for example, was something that Roosevelt was pushing for first Roosevelt was pushing for from a very early age. So he really did shape what came to be in terms of what we think of as the modern progressive state, still being redefined.
Well, Patricia O'Toole, for this book, for this conversation, thank you so very much.
My pleasure, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Patty O'Toole. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our technical director is John Tyler. Our production engineer is Anthony Barber. And our associate producer is Sharana Ward. Dialogue is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.